was it sobbing. The hitcher remembered passing a large house less than a half hour earlier as she hid among the crates. What took 20 minutes in a truck would take pedestrians hours, but she thought they ought to be able to reach the place before dark. The question was the cold. Another was how to stop the crying woman, get her to rest, and once they reached shelter, get her inside it. Eyes like those were not uncommon. In hospitals, they belonged to patients who paced day and night. On the road, unconfined, people with eyes like that would walk forever. The hitcher decided to spend the time talking and started out by introducing herself. Sweetie heard what she said, and for the first time since she'd left her house, stumbled as she turned her smiling or crying face toward the uninvited companion. Sin, she thought. I am walking next to Sin and wrapped in its cloak. Have mercy, she murmured, and gave a little laugh or whimper. By the time they saw the convent, Sweetie was cozy, although she had felt none of the biting cold sweeping the road. She was comforted by the warm snow covering her hair, filling her shoes, and grateful to be so clearly protected from and unassociated with the sin shape walking next to her. The sign of Sweetie's state of grace was how badly the warm snow whipped the shape, silenced it, froze it, and left it breathing heavily, barely able to hang on, while she, Sweetie, marched unbowed through the cutting wind. Of her own accord, Sweetie slogged up the driveway, but she let the demon do the rest. The woman who opened the door to the banging said, "Ooh," and yanked them both inside. They seemed like birds, hawks, to Sweetie, pecking at her, flapping. They made her sweat. Had she been stronger, not so tired from the night shift of tending her babies, she would have fought them off. As it was, other than pray, there was nothing she could do. They put her in a bed under so many blankets, perspiration ran into her ears. Nothing they offered would she eat or drink. Her lips were shut, her teeth clenched. Silently, fervently, she prayed for deliverance. And don't you know she got it? They left her alone. In the quiet room, Sweetie thanked her Lord and drifted into a staticky, troubled sleep. It was the baby cry that woke her, not the shivering. Weak as she was, she got up, or tried to. Her head hurt and her mouth was dry. She noticed that she was not in a bed, but on a leather couch in a dark room. Sweetie's teeth were rattling when one of the hawks, with a blood-red mouth, came into the room carrying a kerosene lamp. It spoke to her in the sweetest voice, the way a demon would. But Sweetie called on her savior, and it left. Somewhere in the house, the child continued to cry, filling Sweetie with rapture. She had never heard that sound from her own, never heard that clear, yearning call, sustained, rhythmic. It was like an anthem, a lullaby, or the bracing chords of the Decalogue. All of her children were silent. Suddenly, in the midst of joy, she was angry. Babies cry here among these demons, but not in her house? When two of the hawks came back, one carrying a tray of food, She asked them, "Why is that child crying here?" They denied it, of course, lied straight through the weeping that sifted through the room. One of them even tried to distract her, saying, "I've heard children laughing, singing sometimes, but never crying." The other one cackled. "Let me out of here." Sweetie struggled to make her voice shout, "I have to get home. I'm going to take you, soon as the car warms up." Same sly, demon tones. "Now," said Sweetie, "take some aspirin and eat some of this. You let me out of this place now." "What a bitch," said one. "It's just fever," said the other. "And keep your mouth shut, can't you?" It was patience and blocking out every sound except the admonitions of her lord that got her out of there. First, into a rusty red car that stalled in the snow at the foot of the driveway. And finally, praise, praise his holy name, into her husband's arms. He was with Anna Flood. They had been on their way from the minute she called on her savior. Sweetie literally fell into Jeff's arms. "What you doing way out here? We couldn't get through all night. Where's your mind, Lord, girl, sweetheart? What happened?" "They made me, snatched me," Sweetie cried. "Oh, God, take me home. I'm sick, Anna, and I have to look after the babies." "Shh, don't worry about that. I have to. It's going to be all right now. Arnett's coming home. Turn the heater up. I'm so cold. How come I'm so cold?" Seneca stared at the ceiling. The cot's mattress was thin and hard. The wool blanket scratched her chin, and her palms hurt from shoveling snow in the driveway. She had slept on floors, on cardboard, on nightmare-producing waterbeds, and for weeks at a time, in the back seat of Eddie's car. But she could not fall asleep on this clean, narrow, childish bed. The crying woman had flipped in the night and the next morning as well. Seneca had spent the whole night up, listening to Mavis and Gigi. The house seemed to belong to them, although they referred to somebody named Connie. They cooked for her and didn't pry. Other than discussing her name, where'd she get it, they behaved as though they knew all about her and were happy for her to stay. Later in the afternoon, when she thought she would drop from exhaustion, they showed her to a bedroom with two cots. "Nap a while," said Mavis. "I'll call you when dinner's ready. You like fried chicken?" Seneca thought she would throw up. They didn't like each other at all, so Seneca had equalized her smiles and agreeableness. If one cursed and joked nastily about the other, Seneca laughed. When the other rolled her eyes in disgust, Seneca shot her an understanding look. Always the peacemaker, the one who said yes, or "I don't mind," or "I'll go." Otherwise, what? They might not like her, might cry, might leave. So she had done her best to please, even if the Bible turned out to be heavier than the shoes. Like all first offenders, he wanted both right away. Seneca had no trouble with the size 11 Adidas, but Preston, Indiana, didn't sport bookstores, religious or regular. She detoured to Bloomington and found something called the Living Bible, and one without color pictures but with lots of lined pages for recording dates of births, deaths, marriages, baptisms. It seemed a marvelous thing, a list of whole family's activities over the years. So she chose it. He was angry, of course, so much that it dimmed his pleasure in the extravagant black and white running shoes. "Can't you get anything right? Just a small Bible, not a goddamn encyclopedia." He was guilty as charged, and she had known him for only 6 months, but already he knew how hopeless she was. He accepted the enormous Bible nonetheless and told her to leave it and the shoes at the desk with his name and number. Made her write it down as though she might have trouble remembering 5 numbers in a row. She had brought ham sandwiches, too. His letter said they could have a picnic-type lunch in the visitors' quarters, but he was too nervous and irritated to eat. The other visitors seemed to be having a lovely time with their prisoners. Children teased each other, curled up in the arms of their fathers, playing with their faces, hair, fingers. Women and girls touched the men, whispered, laughed out loud. They were the regulars, familiar with the bus drivers, the guards, and the coffee wagon personnel. The prisoners' eyes were soft with pleasure. They noticed everything, commented on everything. The report cards the little boys brought to them in fat, brown envelopes, the barrettes in the little girls' hair, the state of the women's coats. They listened carefully to details of friends and family not there, had advice and instruction for every piece of domestic news. They seemed terribly manly to Seneca, leader-like in their management of the visit. From where to sit, where to put the paper wrappings, to medical advice and books to send. What they never spoke of was what was going on inside. They did not ever acknowledge the presence of the guards. Perhaps Attica was on their minds. Maybe, she thought, as his sentence wore on, Eddie would be like that, not furious, victimized, as he was on their first visit since he was arraigned, whining, blaming. The Bible so big, it embarrassed him. Mustard instead of mayo on the sandwiches. He didn't want to hear anything about her new job at a school cafeteria. Only Sophie and Bernard interested him, their diets. Was she letting them out at night? They needed a good long run. Use their muzzles only when they're outside. She left Eddie Turtle in the visitor's hall, promising him 4 things: to send pictures of the dogs, to sell the stereo, to get his mother to cash the savings bonds, to call the lawyer. Send, sell, get, call. That's how she would remember. Heading for the bus shelter, Seneca tripped and fell on one knee. A guard stepped forward and helped her up. "Watch it there, miss." "Sorry." "Thanks. How you girls expect to walk in those things, I don't know." "Supposed to be good for you," she said, smiling. "Where? In Holland?" He laughed pleasantly, showing 2 rows of gold fillings. Seneca adjusted her string bag and asked him, "How far is Wichita from here?" "Depends on how you're traveling. In a car, it'd be, 10, 12 hours. Bus longer." "Oh, you got family in Wichita?" "Yes. No. Well, my boyfriend does. I'm going to pay his mother a visit." The guard removed his cap to smooth his crew cut. "That's nice," he said. "Good barbecue in Wichita. Make sure you get some." Somewhere in Wichita, there probably was very good barbecue, but not in Mrs. Turtle's house. Her house was strictly vegetarian. Nothing with hooves, feathers, shell, or scales appeared on her table. 7 grains and 7 greens. Eat one of each, and only one, each day, and you lived forever. Which she planned to do. And no, she wasn't about to cash in the savings bonds her husband had left her for anybody, let alone somebody who drove a car over a child and left it there, even if that somebody was her only son. Oh, no, Mrs. Hurdle. He didn't know it was a little kid. Eddie thought it was a what? Asked Mrs. Hurdle. What did he think it was? I forgot what he told me, but I know he wouldn't do that. Eddie loves kids. He really does. He's really very sweet. He asked me to bring him a Bible. He sold it by now. Seneca looked away. The television screen flickered. On it, grave-faced men lied softly, courteously, to each other. Little girl, you've known him less than a growing season. I've known him all his life. Yes, ma'am. You think I'm going to let him put me in the poorhouse so a slick lawyer can stay rich? No, ma'am. You've been watching those Watergate lawyers? No, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Well, then, don't say another word about it. You want some supper or not? The grain was wheat bread. The green was kale. Strong iced tea helped wash them both down. Mrs. Turtle did not offer a bed for the night, so Seneca hoisted her bag and walked down the quiet street in Wichita's soft evening air. She had not quit her job to make this trip, but the supervisor made it clear that an absence this soon was not to a new employee's advantage. Perhaps she was already fired. Maybe Mrs. Turtle would let her telephone her housemates to see if anyone had called to say, "Don't bother coming back." Seneca turned around, retracing her steps. At the door, her knuckles lifted for the knock. She heard sobbing, a flat-out helpless mother cry, a sound like no other in the world. Seneca stepped back, then went to the window, pressing her left hand to her chest to keep her heart down. She kept it there, imagining its small red valves stuttering, faltering, trying to get back online as she fled down the brick steps out to the sidewalk, skirting the dirt streets, then macadam, then concrete, all the way to the bus station. Only when she was sitting frog-legged on a molded plastic bench did she surrender to the wails that continued to careen in her head. Alone, without witness, Mrs. Turtle had let go her reason, her personality, and shrieked for all the world like the feathered, finned, and hoofed whose flesh she never ate, the way a gull, a cow whale, a mother wolf might if her young had been snatched away. Her hands had been in her hair, her mouth wide open in a drenched face. Short-breathed and dry-mouthed, Seneca escaped from the sobs, rushing down broad streets and narrow, slowing when near the business part of town. Upon entering the station, she bought peanuts and ginger ale from the vending machines and was immediately sorry, since she really wanted sweet, not salt. Ankles crossed, knees spread, she sat on a bench in the waiting room, pocketed the nuts, and sipped the ginger ale. Finally, her panic subsided, and the screams of a hurt woman were indistinguishable from everyday traffic. Nighttime coming, and the station was as crowded as a morning commuter stop. The warm September day had not cooled when the sun set. There was no worthy difference between the thick air of the waiting room and the air outside. Passengers and their companions appeared calm, hardly interested in the journey or the farewell. Most of the children were asleep on laps, luggage, and seats. Those who were not tortured anyone they could. Adults fingered tickets, blotted dampness from their necks, patted babies, and murmured to each other. Soldiers and sweethearts examined the schedules posted behind the glass. Four teenage boys with stocking caps on their heads sang softly near the vending machines. A man in a gray chauffeur's uniform strolled the floor as though looking for his passenger. A handsome man in a wheelchair navigated himself gracefully through the entrance, only slightly annoyed by the inconvenient design of the door. There were 2 hours and 20 minutes before Seneca's bus departed, so she wondered if she could spend it at one of the movies she'd passed. Serpico, The Exorcist, The Sting were the hot choices, but it felt like betrayal to see any one of them without Eddie's arm around her shoulder. Thinking of his predicament and her bumbling efforts to help him, Seneca sighed heavily, but there was no danger of tears. She had not shed one even when she found Jean's letter next to the Lorna Doones. Well cared for, loved, perhaps, by the mothers in both of the foster homes, she knew it was not herself that the mothers had approved of, but the fact that she took reprimand quietly, ate what was given, shared what she had, and never, ever cried. The ginger ale was rattling through the straw when the chauffeur stood before her and smiled. "Excuse me, miss, may I speak to you for a moment?" "Sure. I mean, sure." Seneca scooted over to make room on the bench, but he did not sit down. "I'm authorized to offer you $500 for some complicated but quite easy work, if you're interested." Seneca opened her mouth to say, "Complicated and easy?" His eyes were cloudy gray, and the buttons on his uniform glimmered like ancient gold. "Oh, no, thanks, but I'm on my way out of here," she said. "My bus leaves in 2 hours." "I understand, but the work won't take long. Perhaps if you talk to my employer, she's right outside. She can describe it to you. Unless, of course, you have to be somewhere in a hurry." "She?" "Yes, Mrs. Fox. Step this way. It'll take just a minute." A limousine throbbed under bright streetlights a few yards from the station entrance. When the chauffeur opened the door, the head of a very pretty woman turned toward Seneca. "Hello. I'm Norma, Norma Keene Fox. I'm looking for some help." She didn't hold out her hand, but her smile made Seneca want her to. "Can I talk to you about it?" The white linen blouse she wore was sleeveless, cut low. Her beige skirt was long. When she uncrossed her legs, Seneca saw bright sandals, coral-painted toenails. Champagne-colored hair rushed back behind ears with no earrings. "What kind of help?" Seneca asked. "Come inside, so I can explain. It's hard talking through an open car door." Seneca hesitated. Mrs. Fox's laugh was a warm tumble of bells. "It's okay, dear. You don't have to take the job if you don't want it." "I didn't say I didn't." Well then, come. It's cooler in here. The door click was soft, but profound, and Mrs. Fox's bal à Versailles was irresistible. Something confidential, she said. Nothing illegal, of course. Just private. You type? A little? I want somebody not from around here. I hope 500 is enough. I could go a little higher for a really intelligent girl. David will drive you back to the bus station, even if you decide not to take the job. Only then did Seneca realize the limousine was no longer parked. The interior lights were still on. The air was cooled. The limousine floated. This is a lovely part of the world, Norma continued, but narrow-minded, if you know what I mean. Still, I wouldn't live anywhere else. My husband doesn't believe me, neither do my friends, because I'm from back east. When I go back there, they say Wichita, like that. But I love it here. Where are you from? I thought so. They don't wear jeans like that around here. They should, though, if they've got the bottom, I mean, like you do. Yes, my son's at Rice. Lots of people work for us, but it's only when Leon is away, that's my husband, that I can get anything accomplished. That's where you come in, if you agree, I mean. Married? Well, what I need done, only an intelligent female can do. You don't wear lipstick, do you? Good. Your lips are lovely like that. I told David, find an intelligent girl, please. No farm girls, no dairy queens. He's very good. He found you. Our place is out of town a ways. No, thank you. I can't digest peanuts. Oh, dear, you must be starving. We'll have a very good supper, and I'll explain what I want done. Really simple, if you can follow directions. It's confidential work, so I prefer to hire a stranger rather than someone local. Are those your own lashes? Gracious. David, do you know if Maddie cooked a real supper tonight? No fish, I hope. Or do you like fish? Trout's wonderful in Kansas. I think some chicken, fried, might do the trick. We have beautifully fed poultry here. They eat better than most people do. No, don't put them away. Give them to me. Who knows? They might come in handy. Seneca spent the following 3 weeks in gorgeous rooms with gorgeous Norma and food too pretty to eat. Norma called her many sweet things, but not once asked what her name was. The front door was never locked, and she could leave any time she wanted to. She didn't have to stay there, moving from peacock feathers to abject humiliation, from coddling to playful abuse, from caviar tartlets to filth. But the pain framed the pleasure, gave it edge. The humiliation made surrender deep, tender, long-lasting. When Leon Fox telephoned his imminent return, Norma gave her the $500 and some clothes, including a cashmere serape. As promised, David drove her to the bus station, his buttons extra gleamy in the sunlight. They did not speak during the drive. Seneca wandered Wichita for hours, stopping at a coffee shop, resting in a city park, at a loss as where to go or what to do, get a job near the prison and stand by him, meaning follow his instructions, apologize for not getting his mother's savings, go back to Chicago, pick up her life before Eddie, instant friends, catch quick jobs, temporary housing, stolen food. Eddie Turtle had been settled life to her for 6 months, and now he was gone. Or should she just move on? The chauffeur had picked her up for Norma like a stray puppy. No, not even that, but like a pet you wanted to play with for a while. A little while, but not to keep. Not love. Not name it. Just feed it, play with it, then return it to its own habitat. She had $500, and other than Eddie, no one knew where she was. Maybe she ought to keep it that way. Seneca hadn't decided much of anything when she saw the first place to hide, a flatbed loaded with cement sacks. When she was discovered, the driver held her against a tire, splicing his questions, curses, and threats with mild flirtations. Seneca said nothing at first, then suddenly begged permission to go to the bathroom. "I have to go bad," she said. The driver sighed and released her, shouting a final warning at her back. She hitched a few times after that, but so disliked the necessary talk, she accepted the risk of stowing away in trucks. She preferred traveling resolutely nowhere, closed off from society, hidden among quiet cargo, no one knowing she was there. When she found herself among crates in a brand new 73 pickup, jumping out of it to follow a coatless woman was the first pointedly uninstructed thing she had ever done. The sobbing, or was she giggling, woman was gone now. The snow had stopped. Downstairs, someone was calling her name. "Seneca? Seneca? Come on, baby. We're waiting for you." Divine. Let me tell you about love, that silly word you believe is about whether you like somebody, or whether somebody likes you, or whether you can put up with somebody in order to get something or someplace you want, or you believe it has to do with how your body responds to another body like robins or bison, or maybe you believe love is how forces of nature or luck is benign to you in particular, not maiming or killing you, but if so, doing it for your own good. Love is none of that. There's nothing in nature like it. Not in robins or bison, or in the banging tails of your hunting dogs, and not in blossoms or suckling foal. Love is divine only, and difficult always. If you think it is easy, you are a fool. If you think it is natural, you are blind. It is a learned application without reason or motive, except that it is God. You do not deserve love, regardless of the suffering you have endured. You do not deserve love because somebody did you wrong. You do not deserve love just because you want it. You can only earn, by practice and careful contemplation, the right to express it, and you have to learn how to accept it. Which is to say, you have to earn God. You have to practice God. You have to think God carefully. And if you are a good and diligent student, you may secure the right to show love. Love is not a gift, it is a diploma conferring certain privileges, the privilege of expressing love and the privilege of receiving it. How do you know you have graduated? You don't. What you know is that you are human and therefore educable and therefore capable of learning how to learn, and therefore interesting to God, who is interested only in himself, which is to say he is interested only in love. Do you understand me? God is not interested in you. He is interested in love and the bliss it brings to those who understand and share that interest. Couples that enter the sacrament of marriage and are not prepared to go the distance or are not willing to get right with the real love of God cannot thrive. They may cleave together like robins or gulls or anything else that mates for life. But if they eschew this mighty course at the moment when all are judged for the disposition of their eternal lives, their cleaving won't mean a thing. God bless the pure and holy. Amen. Some of the amens that accompanied and followed Reverend Senior Pulliam's words were loud, others withholding. Some people did not open their mouths at all. The question, thought Anna, was not why, but who. Who was Pulliam blasting? Was he directing his remarks to the young people, warning them to shape up their selfish lives? Or was he aiming at their parents for allowing the juvenile restlessness and defiance that had been rankling him even before that fist appeared on the oven? Most likely, she thought, he was bringing the weight of his large and long Methodist education to bear down on Richard, a stone to crush his colleague's message of God as a permanent interior engine that once ignited, roared, purred, and moved you to do your own work as well as his. But if idle, rusted, immobilizing the soul like a frozen clutch. That must be it, she thought. Pulliam was targeting Meisner, because surely he would not stand before the bride and groom, a guest preacher, asked to make a few remarks before the ceremony to a congregation made up of almost everybody in Ruby, only a third of whom were members of Pulliam's church, and frightened them to death on their wedding day. Because surely he would not insult the bride's mother and sister-in-law, who wore like a coat the melancholy of tending broken babies, and who not only had not chastised God for that knockout blow to everything they dreamed of, but seemed to increase in steadfastness as each year passed. And although the groom had no living parents, surely Pulliam did not intend to embarrass his aunts, to put the feet of those devout women to the fire for caring too much, perhaps, for the sole son the family would ever have, now that Soane's boys were dead. Dovey having none, and not allowing the mourning for either of those losses to tear them up or close their hearts. Surely not. And surely Pulliam was not trying to rile the groom's uncles, deacon and steward, who behaved as if God were their silent business partner. Pulliam had always seemed to admire them, hinting repeatedly that they belonged in Zion, not Calvary, where they had to listen to the namby-pamby sermons of a man who thought teaching was letting children talk as if they had something important to say that the world had not heard and dealt with already. Who else would feel the sting of God is not interested in you, or wince from the burn in if you think love is natural, you are blind? Who else but Richard Meisner, who now had to stand up and preside over the most anticipated wedding anyone could remember under the boiling breath of Senior Take No Prisoners Pulliam? Unless, of course, he was talking to her, telling her, cleave unto another if you want. But if you are not cleaving to God, Pulliam's God, that is, your marriage will not be worth the license, because he knew she and Richard were talking marriage, and he knew she helped him organize the young disobedience. Be the furrow. Rogue meant overwhelmed the flower arrangements around the altar, clumps of it, along with a flocks called Wild Sweet William, grew beneath the church windows that at 11 o'clock were opened to a climbing sun. The light falling from the April sky was a gift. Inside the church, the maple wood pews burnished to a military glow set off the spring white walls, the understated pulpit, the comfortable, almost picket fence look of the railing, where communicants could kneel to welcome the spirit one more time. Above the altar, high into its clean, clear space, hung a 3-foot oak cross, uncluttered, unencumbered. No gold competed with its perfection or troubled its poise. No writhe or swoon of the body of Christ bloated its lyric thunder. The women of Ruby did not powder their faces, and they wore no harlot's perfume. So the voluptuous odor of mint and sweet William disturbed the congregation, made it reel in anticipation of a good time with plenty good food at Soane Morgan's house. There would be music by anyone. July on the upright piano, the male chorus, a Kate Golightly solo, the Holy Redeemer Quartet, a dreamy-eyed boy named Brood on the steps with a mouth organ. There would be the press of good clothing, silk dresses and starched shirts, forgotten as folks leaned against trees, sat on the grass, mishandled second helpings of cream peas. There would be the shouts of sugar-drunk children, the crackle of wedding gift paper snatched from the floor and folded so neatly it seemed more valuable than the gift it had enclosed. Farmers, ranchers, and wheat-growing women would let themselves be yanked from chairs and clapped into repeating dance steps from long ago. Teenagers would laugh and blink their eyes in an effort to hide their want. But more than joy and children high on wedding cake, they were looking forward to the union of two families and an end to the animus that had soaked the members and friends of those families for 4 years. Animus that centered on the maybe baby the bride had not acknowledged, announced, or delivered. Now they sat, as did Anna Flood, wondering what on earth Reverend Pulliam thought he was doing. Why cast a pall now? Why diminish the odor of rogue mint and phlox, blunt the taste of roast lamb and lemon pies awaiting them? Why fray the harmony, derail the peace this marriage brought? Richard Meisner rose from his seat, annoyed. No, angry. So angry he could not look at his fellow preacher and let him see how deep the cut. Throughout Pulliam's remarks, he had gazed expressionless at the Easter hats of the women in the pews. Earlier that morning, he had planned 5 or 6 opening sentences to launch the sacred rite of matrimony, crafted them carefully around Revelation 19:7-9, sharpening the marriage supper of the Lamb image, coring it to reveal the reconciliation this wedding promised. He has segued from Revelation to Matthew 19:6, wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh, to seal not only the couple's fidelity to each other, but the renewed responsibilities of all Morgans and Fleetwoods. Now he looked at the couple standing patiently before the altar and wondered whether they had understood or even heard what had been laid on them. He, however, did understand, knew this lethal view of his chosen work was a deliberate assault on all he believed. Suddenly, he understood and shared Augustine's rage at the proud minister whom he ranked with the devil. Augustine had gone on to say that God's message was not corrupted by the messenger. If the light should pass through defiled beings, it is not itself defiled. Although Augustine had not met Senior Pulliam, he must have known ministers like him. But his dismissal of them to Satan's company did not acknowledge the damage words spoken from a pulpit could wreak. What would Augustine say as anodyne to the poison Pulliam had just sprayed over everything, over the heads of men, finding it so hard to fight their instincts to control what they could and crunch what they could not, in the hearts of women tirelessly taming the predator, in the faces of children not yet recovered from the blow to their esteem upon learning that adults would not regard them as humans until they mated, of the bride and groom frozen there, desperate for this public bonding to dilute their private shame. Miser knew that Pulliam's words were a widening of the war he had declared on Meisner's activities, tempting the young to step outside the wall, outside the town limits, shepherding them, forcing them to transgress, to think of themselves as civil warriors. He knew also that a public secret about a never-born baby poked through the grounds of the quarrel like a fang. Suitable language came to mind, but not trusting himself to deliver it without revealing his deep personal hurt, Meisner walked away from the pulpit to the rear wall of the church. There he stretched, reaching up until he was able to unhook the cross that hung there. He carried it then, past the empty choir stall, past the organ where Kate sat, the chair where Pulliam was, on to the podium, and held it before him for all to see, if only they would. See what was certainly the first sign any human anywhere had made. The vertical line, the horizontal one. Even as children, they drew it with their fingers in snow, sand, or mud. They laid it down as sticks in the dirt, arranged it from bones on frozen tundra and broad savannas, as pebbles on riverbanks scratched in on cave walls and outcroppings from Nome to South Africa. Algonquin and Laplanders, Zulu and Druids, all had a finger memory of this original mark. The circle was not first, nor was the parallel or the triangle. It was this mark, this, that lay underneath every other. This mark, rendered in the placement of facial features. This mark of a standing human figure poised to embrace. Remove it, as Pulliam had done, and Christianity was like any and every religion in the world, a population of supplicants begging respite from begrudging authority, harried believers ducking fate or dodging everyday evil, the weak negotiating a doomed trek through the wilderness, the sighted ripped of light and thrown into the perpetual dark of choicelessness. Without this sign, the believer's life was confined to praising God and taking the hits. The praise was credit. The hits were interest due on a debt that could never be paid. Or, as Pulliam put it, no one knew when he had graduated. But with it, in the religion in which this sign was paramount and foundational, well, life was a whole other matter. See, the execution of this one solitary black man, propped up on these two intersecting lines to which he was attached in a parody of human embrace, fastened to two big sticks that were so convenient, so recognizable, so embedded in consciousness as consciousness, being both ordinary and sublime. See, his woolly head alternately rising on his neck and falling toward his chest, the glow of his midnight skin dimmed by dust, streaked by gall, fouled by spit and urine, gone pewter in the hot, dry wind, and finally, as the sun dimmed in shame, as his flesh matched the odd lessening of afternoon light, as though it were evening, always sudden in that climate, swallowing him and the other death row felons, and the silhouette of this original sign merged with the false night sky. See how this official murder, out of hundreds, marked the difference, moved the relationship between God and man from CEO and supplicant to one-on-one. The cross he held was abstract. The absent body was real. But both combined to pull humans from backstage to the spotlight, from muttering in the wings to the principal role in the story of their lives. This execution made it possible to respect freely, not in fear, oneself and one another, which was what love was. Unmotivated respect, all of which testified not to a peevish Lord who was his own love, but to one who enabled human love. Not for his own glory, never. God loved the way humans loved one another, loved the way humans loved themselves, loved the genius on the cross who managed to do both and die knowing it. But Richard Meisner could not speak calmly of these things, so he stood there and let the minutes tick by as he held the crossed oak in his hands, urging it to say what he could not. That not only is God interested in you, he is you. Would they see? Would they? For those who could see it, the groom's face was a study. He looked up at the cross Reverend Meisner was holding, saying nothing, just holding it there in locked time, while the unendurable silence was sprinkled with coughs and soft, encouraging grunts. People were already nervous about his wedding because buzzards had been seen flying north over the town. The question in their minds was whether that was an omen for harm, they circled the town, or for good, none landed. Simpletons, he thought. If this marriage was doomed, it had nothing to do with birds. Suddenly, the open windows were not enough. The groom began to perspire in his beautifully cut black suit. Anger shot through him like a 32. Why was everybody using his wedding, messing up his ceremony to extend a quarrel he could care less about? He wanted it over and done with, so his uncles would shut up, so Jeff and Fleet would stop spreading lies about him, so he could take his place among the married and propertied men of Ruby, so he could burn all those letters from Arnett, but especially so he could flush that Gigi bitch out of his life completely, like sugar turning from unreasonable delight to the body's mortal enemy. His craving for her had poisoned him, rendered him diabetic, stupid, helpless. Following months of risky sweetness, she had become indifferent, bored, even hateful. In tall corn, he had waited for her. In moonlight, he had crept behind hen houses to meet her, spent money that was not his to entertain her, lied to get something other than a truck to drive her, planted a marijuana crop for her, carried ice in August heat to cool the inside of her thighs, bought her a battery-powered radio she adored, a chenille robe she laughed at. Most of all, he had loved her for years, an aching, humiliating, self-loathing love that drifted from pining to stealth. He had read the first letter he got from Arnett, but put the others in a shoebox in his aunt's attic. He was in a hurry to destroy them, or maybe even read them, before anybody discovered the 11 unopened envelopes posted from Langston, Oklahoma. He assumed they were all about love and grief, love in spite of grief, whatever. But what could Arnett know of either the way he did? Had she sat through the night in a copse of Shen Oak to catch a glimpse? Had she trailed a beat-up Cadillac all the way to Denby just to see? Had she been thrown out of a house by women, cursed by women, and still been unable to stay away? Not, that is, until his uncle sat him down and gave him the law and its consequences. So here he was, standing at the altar, his elbow supporting the thin wrist of his bride. In his pocket, the fold of Easter palm she had given him for protection. He was aware of the heavy breathing of his soon-to-be brother-in-law at his right, and the animosity of Billy Delia burrowing into the back of his head. He was certain it would go on forever, this blocked rage, because Meisner seemed to be struck dumb by the cross he held. Across, the bride gazed at in terror, and she had been so happy. At last, so very, very happy, free of the bleak sadness that encased her as soon as she was home from college, the unrelenting suffocation in her parents' house, the brand new disgust that accompanied the care of her broken nieces and nephews, the need for sleep that alarmed her mother, annoyed her sister-in-law, and infuriated her brother and father. The flat-out nothing-to-do-ness, interrupted only by wonder and worry about KD. Although he had never answered her first 12 letters, she kept on writing, but not mailing, 40 more. Once a week, for the whole first year, she was away. She believed she loved him absolutely, because he was all she knew about herself, which was to say, everything she knew of her body was connected to him. Except for Billy Delia, no one had told her there was any other way to think of herself, not her mother, not her sister-in-law. Last year, when she was a senior, she came home for Easter break, and he asked to see her, came twice for dinner, took her to Nathan Dupre's ranch to help with the Children's Day picnic, and then suggested they get married. It was a miracle that lasted all the way down to this brilliant day in April. Everything perfect. Her period had come and gone. Her gown, made entirely of sewn Morgan's lace, was heavenly. The gold band tucked into her brother's vest was engraved with both their initials entwined. The hole in her heart had closed, finally. And now, at the last minute, the preacher was rocking strange, trying to hold up the marriage, distort, maybe even destroy it. Standing there, his face like granite, holding a cross as though nobody had ever seen one before, she pressed her fingers into the arm that held hers, willing Meisner to get on with it. Say it, say it. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here, we are gathered here. Suddenly, soundlessly, in the muffled silence that Meisner imposed, a tiny rent opened in exactly the place where her heart's hole had been. She held her breath and felt the increase like a run in the stocking. Soon, the little tear would yawn, stretch wide